Hello, everybody. Welcome to Indie Week. John Federson here for the North Carolina Reading Service. We're offering this program, as always, for our audience of blind and print-impaired listeners. And the date for this weekly issue of The Independent is January 31st of 2025. My issue of Indie Week, which is also available from IndieWeek.com, by the way, for which you can see many more articles than I have a chance to read each week. The first, as this particular week, we have we're fairly light on, let's say, hardcore political and national interests and even statewide interest, but I'll read three articles, and the first is short. Wake Democrats select former federal prosecutor to succeed Representative Joe John in the North Carolina House. Representative John died last week. Phil Rubin has been selected. He's a former assistant U.S. attorney and NC Justice Department lawyer who now works for Meta. Members of the Wake Democrats executive committee selected him over two other candidates Tuesday night. Rubin said he sought the House District 40 seat because he wanted to, quote, help share our visions for a better North Carolina, one where our people's votes matter, their views matter, and their families matter. After he won, Rubin said that John had embodied public service. John died shortly after he resigned his seat with the announcement he'd received a diagnosis of terminal cancer. He was a former judge who served four full terms in the House. He was elected to a fifth term in November. Rubin said, I recognize it's an impossible task to fill his shoes, but I promise that I will give every bit of my effort to try and to listen as well as to be heard and represent you in a way that would make you and him proud. Under state law, members of county political parties recommend a candidate to fill an unexpired term in the legislature. Governor Josh Stein must appoint the person the local party committee chooses. The candidates spoke about the district as a likely target for Republicans next year and promised to fight hard to keep it in Democratic hands. The legislature begins meeting regularly on Wednesday. Wake Democratic Party Chair Kevin Creech said the hope was to have John's successor sworn in and seated before the end of the week. Executive Committee members selected Sophia Jackson, Chief Strategy Officer at the NC Partnership for Children Smart Start Network, to fill Matt Calabria's seat on the Wake County Board of Commissioners. Jackson, who ran for a House seat last year, was chosen over four other candidates. Calabria resigned after Stein appointed him director of the Governor's Recovery Office for Western North Carolina. The party's choice goes to the Wake Board of Commissioners, whose members will vote on Calabria's successor. Also from specifically to Raleigh, well, not quite as just Raleigh itself, but we've been reading about this particular issue for a few weeks now. This time, the North Carolina Department of Justice finds, quote, red flags in a proposed contract between St. Augustine's University and 50 plus one sports. The Justice Department has, quote, serious concerns about a land lease contract that St. Augs is prepared to sign with a real estate development firm, 50 plus one sports, according to a letter the department sent to that university on Monday. Quote, we are concerned about SAU's ability to continue and operate and fulfill its mission if this proposed lease agreement is finalized without substantive improvements, Kunal Choksi, Senior Deputy Attorney General and Director of the DOJ's Consumer Protection Division. Since SAU is a nonprofit and the contract encompasses all or a majority of its property, the State Department of Justice is legally obligated to review and approve it before any money can change hands between 50 plus one and SAU. Although the review is not yet complete, Choksi's letter suggests that the agency is unlikely to approve the contract in its current form. Again, SAU sits on about 105 acres of land near downtown Raleigh, and it has said it's prepared to lease its entire property to 50 plus one for a 99-year term in exchange for a $70 million lease payment. 50 plus one, in turn, has said it plans to build a mixed-use development on part of the property and lease the rest back to the university. According to Choksi's letter, the initial lease payment specified in the contract, quote, between $20 million and $70 million, a sum which in the DOJ's assessment is, quote, too low to justify the lease of the entire property. That property has been appraised at over $198 million. That larger gap raises red flags about the defensibility of the deal, wrote Choksi. Absent further information or justification, the deal should be renegotiated to, among other things, reflect the true value of the property being transferred. In the past, 50 plus 1 has justified the $70 million lease fee by offering the university a 35% share in the net revenue from the development it plans to build on the property. Monty Valery, a managing partner at 50 plus 1, told Indy in December that he estimates SAU could make $1 billion from this deal though through this revenue-sharing agreement. But in the letter, Choksi said the university has not provided any evidence or justification for that estimate. Also missing from the materials that the department requested from the university was evidence that it had completed due diligence on 50 plus 1 and its financials, according to Choksi's letter. Quote, SAU, despite repeated requests, has not provided any such diligence to this office, including any documentation of financing 50 plus 1 has secured to meet its payment obligations. Details about similar deals 50 plus 1 has developed, including deals with other universities or the company's audited financial statements, wrote Choksi. The department also has questions about whether this deal aligns with SAU's charitable mission as a nonprofit university. According to the letter, following through on the land lease with 50 plus 1 could put the school at risk of losing its nonprofit status. Choksi wrote, there is a precedent for the IRS revoking and the courts upholding the revocation of a 501c3 nonprofit tax-exempt status on grounds and circumstances analogous to this proposed transaction, unquote. The department also has unanswered questions about how much of the university's property 50 plus 1 plans to develop. Choksi wrote, we have requested information on how this transaction will preserve and revive SAU's educational mission and finances, including site plans showing which property 50 plus 1 intends to develop and which it will preserve for educational purposes. Prior to receiving this letter, SAU had been aggressively lobbying the Department of Justice to greenlight its partnership with 50 plus 1 so it could collect the initial lease fee ahead of a hearing this next month, February, with its accreditor, the Southern Association of Colleges and Schools Commission on Colleges, SACSCOC. After a year of declining enrollment, layoffs, and accumulating debt, SAU is under immense pressure to show that association it can recover financially, lest it lose accreditation. In his letter, Choksi now acknowledged the university's imminent deadline with the association and offered to work with the school to get an extension from the accreditor. Quote, we have a duty to ensure that nonprofit assets within North Carolina are protected, and that extends to helping our HBCUs thrive and give their students the education that will help them succeed. We, like you, want to ensure that SAU can continue to operate in the short term and succeed in the long term. And the longest article of what I would call hard news affecting the entire state, NC Supreme Court ballot challenge hits young voters hard. Story Wertheimer wrote this for Indy. Rhiannon Camarillo left the polls in November, feeling confident she had done everything right. She had gathered all the proper materials, voted early, and even visited the Durham County Board of Elections office in person months in advance to verify her registration was accurate. She says, "I took every step I could to mitigate the risk. I felt confident enough I was educating other people about how to cast their vote and sharing resources about what steps to take." Camarillo, a 21-year-old Duke University public policy major, is deeply involved in voting rights organizations on campus. She served as project director for Project Citizen. That's a program that teaches first-year students about civic engagement, and works with the Student Voting Rights Lab at Duke University and NC Central. Leading up to the election, her team sent thousands of texts and emails to students across the state to help them navigate this voter registration process. Despite her preparation, Camarillo finds herself among 60,000 legal North Carolina's voters whose ballots are being challenged. Jefferson Griffin, the Republican candidate for the North Carolina Supreme Court, is seeking to disqualify these votes after three separate counts confirmed the narrow victory of his opponent, Democratic incumbent Justice Allison Riggs. Riggs won by just 734 votes out of more than 5.5 million ballots cast. Among those whose ballots are under examination, young people like Camarillo are disproportionately affected. An analysis by the Voting Rights Lab found 12,600 voters aged 18 through 25 are included in Griffin's challenge, making youth voters 3.5 times more likely than those over 65 years old to have their ballots questioned. In urban counties, the disparities are starker. Youth voters in Durham were nearly 7 times more likely to have their votes challenged, the analysis found. Voting Rights Lab Director Gunther Peck, a Duke history professor, argues that Griffin's challenge is a direct attack on youth voting rights. "It's so deeply unethical and unfair," said Peck. "People are watching, and if this is successful here, then the weapon works. It's bad not just for Democrats. This is bad for Republicans, too." Camarillo was both disheartened and surprised to hear that her ballot could be tossed. "I was just so excited about this," she said. "This was my first time voting. I have my noble I voted sticker on my wall. And to be one of the people whose vote is now not being counted, it goes against all the drive I had this election." Griffin's challenge focuses on voters with, quote, incomplete registration, arguing their files lacked either a driver's license or a social security number. Yet Griffin was selective in targeting that category. His campaign only challenged absentee and early ballots. More than 28,000 voters with similar registration issues who cast their ballots on Election Day were excluded from Griffin's challenge. His protest also excludes over 159,000 voters with the same registration issue who registered before 2004. These exempted voters are older, whiter, and more likely to be Republican, according to the Voting Rights Lab's analysis. The challenged voters are disproportionately younger and disproportionately black, their analysis shows. Griffin says he's protesting the count of unlawful ballots. His petition reads, "This case presents a fundamental question. Is it the people and their elected representatives or unelected bureaucrats sitting in the state boards of elections?" Griffin's team, however, has not proven any cases of fraud among the 60,000 ballots. The State Board of Elections says voters remain eligible even if their files lack a driver's license or social security number, as long as they present a valid ID, something every voter was required to do before casting a ballot. The lab has not yet examined the NC Central data, but has looked closely at numbers for Duke. Peck says that so far, among the 492 Duke undergraduates whose ballots are being contested, his team has not found a single instance of a student making a mistake while registering. Instead, it appears that students are paying the price for clerical and procedural errors by others. Peck said there are flaws and small clerical duplications that are built into the existing system that should be fixed. But all sides know that that's how the system works in an election. It's not fraud. It's not malicious. He continued, what is fraudulent is changing the rules in the midst of an election and weaponizing the system. The future of the challenged votes now rests with the courts. After the State Board of Elections, which has a Democratic majority, rejected the protests last month, Griffin appealed to the state Supreme Court. And in a 4-2 decision, the Republican-dominated court blocked the certification of Riggs's win. Just one Republican, Justice Richard Dietz, broke ranks with his colleagues and dissented from the decision, writing the ruling, quote, invites incredible mischief and seeks to remove the legal right to vote from people who lawfully voted. The State Board of Elections and Justice Riggs were scheduled to file a response brief with the state Supreme Court today. The Board of Elections has also filed an appeal with the Federal Fourth Circuit Court of Appeals, and oral arguments are scheduled for January 27th in Richmond, Virginia. The court's decisions could have far-reaching implications, not only for those 60,000 ballots, but also for the balance of power in North Carolina's highest court. Among other things, the state Supreme Court plays a decisive role in ruling on the state's election districts, which are currently gerrymandered to favor Republicans. If Riggs loses her seat, Republicans will further solidify their hold on the court with a 6-1 majority. At Duke University, many students remain unaware that their votes are being contested. The protest was filed when many were away for winter break. While some received letters in the mail from the state Republican Party, others only learned about it through professors or peers who saw their names on the list. Kyle Abram, a senior, said he learned his vote was being challenged when his engineering dean sent him an email. I was so confused, he said. I totally thought the email was a scam. Sarah Kate Ashton, another senior, also received the news in an email from a faculty member. I was confused and stressed when I got the email because I really wanted my vote to count. Sophia Dib Gomez, a freshman who works with this voting rights lab, was also surprised to find her name on the list. She helped register hundreds of students to vote through the campus organization Duke Votes. I double-checked my ballot like 20 times because I wanted to make sure everything was perfect, including my registration. I wish I had evidence to prove I did it correctly, but I know that I did. I'm insanely frustrated. Sophia Bliss-Carcosa, a senior whose vote is being questioned, said she brought three different forms of identification to the voting booth to ensure her vote would count. And it's not just students who've been affected. For instance, a disproportionate number of Durham County ballots are included in DeGriffin's protest. Phil Napoli, director of the DeWitt Wallace Center for Media and Democracy at Duke University, and a public policy professor, is among those whose votes have been challenged. He says he's been registered to vote in the state for almost 9 years and never encountered issues before. I'm cynically bemused, Napoli said. Nothing surprises me anymore, but I would be infuriated if my ballot were thrown away, and that has an impact on the ultimate election outcome. In response to this challenge, some Duke students have rallied to spread awareness. On Friday afternoon, students from the Voting Rights Lab set up a table on the main campus plaza where passersby could search for their names on the list of contested voters. Many students who stopped by learned for the first time that their votes had been challenged. They were encouraged to record testimonial videos, complete a voter challenge questionnaire, and send emails to Jefferson Griffin's campaign and to Paul Newby, Chief Justice of the State Supreme Court. Currently, there is no easy way for voters to remove themselves from Griffin's list. The State Board of Elections advises those concerned about their registration to contact their county board to update their information. While this may protect their eligibility in future elections, it probably won't make a difference in this one. The fate of those 60,000 ballots will likely be decided in court. Steve Rawson, chair of the Durham Democratic Party, says the party is launching a public pressure campaign to urge Griffin to withdraw his protest. Rawson says a party and a candidate who lost legitimately but don't like the outcome of that election are resorting to trying to retroactively cancel lawful votes. That is a massive concern for the integrity of our democracy. Peck is also encouraging students to speak up and share their stories. Students on the list did not do anything wrong, Peck said, but they need to fight for their rights because that's the world we live in now. Well, on to Cultureville. What to do in the Triangle this week? And this is a very brief selection from the editors of Indie Week about selecting from the many, many things you could attend, but they're only picking a few each week. And the first one is What to Watch Today at 7 p.m., Rubenstein Arts Center, Durham, Anatomy of a Fall. Justine Triet's 2023 procedural thriller will have you on the edge of your seat asking, did she do it? Wait, do French courts really work that way? The aftermath of a marital dispute when a man falls to his death. Or did he? The film is a slow burn, details minute and austere, but it will leave you up late at night googling theories. So this is, again, tonight, 7 p.m., Rubenstein Arts Center, Anatomy of a Fall. Admission is free there. All right, and another thing, beginning today and ending mid-February, Paint Me This House of Love. That's over at Raleigh's Burning Coal Theater, premiering not one but two plays. The first, comedy, Paint Me This House of Love, will see the United States stage for the first time when Jules Ali Goines shows up at the door of his daughter Cecilia, who's been estranged from him for over two decades. They embark on a home renovation project, and wounds from the past inevitably surface in clever dialogue by playwright Chelsea Woolley. Now, Burning Coal is definitely admission. But Burning Coal is, you can get, Being Chaka follows Paint Me This House of Love with March 13th opening date. If you bundle tickets for both plays, Burning Coal offers a steep discount. So Burning Coal Theater is where you would inquire about times and admission price. Another to attend, Night Sky with Exit Wounds. This is today and tomorrow at Art Space and Studio in Chapel Hill. Art Space, current Art Space and Studio, Chapel Hill. Before Ocean Vuong shook the literary world with his novel On Earth We're Briefly Gorgeous, he had established himself with Night Sky with Exit Wounds, and that is a poetry collection that weaves together the aftermath of the Vietnam War with themes of queerness, displacement, and generational trauma. Now, composer Bryce Dessner and theater artist Kaneza Shal are transforming Night Sky into a multimedia piece, featuring vocals from soprano Fleur Baron, as well as orchestration and visuals. Now, this is a part of the Carolina Performing Arts season, and that is the art space and studio beginning today and tomorrow. That work in progress showing. And so you would go to Art Space website to find out the ticket information. Now, something to hear. January 31st at the A.J. Fletcher Theater in Raleigh. Hang on just a second. Yep, January 31st, Friday, 7:30 p.m. That's on the NC State campus, A.J. Fletcher Theater. And the Chirpy Cheeky In Spite of Ourselves, that's a duet album with John Prine. Iris DeMent is a legend of her own accord, a steady catalog dating back to the early 90s. Now touring with Brooklyn musician Anna Egge, E-G-G-E. The country folk songwriter is at her best when she's lifting her sweet, full-bodied voice in hopes of a better world. And listen to this concert if you like Emmylou Harris, Lucinda Williams, or Tift Merritt. And you can hear at least her perform live, as I said, 7:30 p.m. Friday night at the A.J. Fletcher Theater. And you can look at the A.J. Fletcher Theater box office for tickets information. Something to attend, again, Friday evening at 7:30, the Reynolds Industry Theater in Durham, States of Hope. That's Hope Boykin Dance. States of Hope Boykin, a Durham native, demonstrates how much bodily work is behind the scenes, choreographing a performance of seven dancers who act out Boykin's states of being on stage: determined, conformist, cynical, convinced, angry, daughter of Job, and worried. The New York Times has called this Boykin's most vulnerable and ambitious work yet. As the saying goes, we all contain multitudes. Well, here's a chance to see those multitudes embodied in a state-of-the-art performance. Again, 7:30 p.m., Reynolds Theater in Durham. States of Hope is the title of this dance program. Now, here's a very interesting article to my mind. It's an interview with the creator of How to Make Friends in Durham. If you've scrolled the Durham subreddit, you've seen the recurrent posts. How do I make friends here? New to Durham, looking to meet people. Anyone want to hang out? These, of course, are evergreen questions. Rather than letting these scattered asks fade into the void, Mary Parsons, a local anxiety and OCD therapist, decided to create something more lasting. And this January, she launched How to Make Friends in Durham. That's a crisp, colorful website meant to serve as a primer for connection-seeking Durhamites. Visitors can browse local groups organized by category: sports, arts, environment, service and activism, games, music, or navigate over to the More Fun page for broader resources like Durham County Library events, neighborhood listservs, and curated event calendars. Parsons, 33, says, "I realize there's so many people who just don't know where to start or feel overwhelmed by all the options. My hope was to create a database where I could compile and organize a lot of the options so taking that first step could be that much easier." Her vision is for the site to evolve alongside Durham's social landscape, with community members contributing their own suggestions to build an ever-expanding resource. Indy reached out to Parsons to learn more about her perspective on making friends as an adult, the power of external motivation, and building community in that post-pandemic world. So this is a Q&A format. Indy. I read the bio on your website. You were originally from Clayton and went to UNC Chapel Hill, and you've been in Durham the past 9 years. Do you think staying within a fairly tight geographic radius has helped you maintain and build friendships? Or does being a local versus a transplant not matter as much as we might think? Parsons answers, I think it definitely did help. I swear there's a UNC Chapel Hill to Durham pipeline. I know so many from UNC that now live in Durham. I got to grow more comfortable exploring Durham with people right there beside me. I think if I had come in on my own and didn't know anybody, it would have taken a lot more bravery to get involved in some of these things. Tell me more about your friendship journey as an adult. I've always had a pretty robust group of friends in different stages in my life, but I think it felt the hardest coming out of the pandemic, because I had also transitioned to working from home, and so my social life really hit a rough point. I realized I had to take a more active role in building a social life and building friendships and maintaining them. That makes sense, asks Indy. It does feel like there's been such a huge shift in the wake of the pandemic. In some ways, it's staggering seeing all of these different activities laid out on your site, like there's clearly no shortage of things to do, places to go, places to meet people, but it takes so much effort and motivation, and it feels like it almost doesn't occur to people. I talk to my clients a lot about external versus internal motivation. I think we all really want to be internally motivated. We all want to go outside and see people and do things that are good for us. But I don't think most of us have the self-discipline of Navy SEALs. I found that what I have to do is rely on external motivation. I have to sign up for clubs and teams that I know expect me to be there every week. I need that external piece to make me actually get up and go do it. If you're going to a new activity or new group, do you think it's better to push yourself to go alone, if that might end up actually creating more connections with new people? Or can it be good to have someone there as a crutch? I think it's whatever gets you there. If you won't go without a crutch, then go with a crutch. If you can go on your own, I think you're right. Typically is when, at least for me, it forces me to make conversation and meet new people if I don't have someone there to fall back on. There are different types of friend-making activities, structured groups like chess clubs, interaction is built in, looser activities like run clubs where chatting is optional, and platforms, especially for those friend-seeking, like Bumble BFF. Do you have thoughts on these different approaches? Is one better for certain personality types? I don't know that I have any groundbreaking thoughts on that. I think you're right. There are different ones for different personality types. I can speak for me. While I really like activities where I can talk to someone for a long time, I'm a therapist, so I can make conversation. I really enjoy doing something and having something to bond over, as opposed to just trying to hear facts about other people's lives. Among all the groups and activities listed on your site, are there ones that you've personally tried or been part of? Yes, quite a few. The ones I'm involved with right now are Durham Soccer Academy, which is a backyard 3-on-3 soccer league that I really love. I'm also a part of a 9-by-9 women's soccer league through the city of Durham. I'm a member of the Recreation Advisory Commission for Parks and Rec in Durham. There's a section on their site for boards and commissions. And I've also volunteered with Keep Durham Beautiful. Their final question here is, as an OCD and anxiety therapist, how has your professional experience shaped your understanding of friendship making? In general, she answers, even though I treat anxiety and OCD, I've seen that loneliness is just rampant. I have so many conversations with clients who feel really lonely and isolated. Being a therapist has taught me a lot about how common it is. Most people I talk to still feel alone in their loneliness. They think that most people have really robust social lives, and they're the only ones struggling with this. But I could have 5 conversations a day with clients dealing with the same things. Being a therapist has also shaped my understanding of friendship in broadening what I view as hanging out. I've got a lot of young clients who spend a ton of time on Discord with their friends or play games online and have great friends from there. That has really broadened my understanding of what friendship can look like. I do worry, of course, about people spending that much time online, but it's kind of like the crutch example you mentioned earlier. I would take that over nothing. Now I can offer us another interview format, this interview with Bridget Bell. And this is concerning a collection of poems, a debut collection of poems on postpartum depression. And that book is to be released on February 4th, coming right up. And it's called All That We Ask of You Is to Always Be Happy. And Cavan Carey Press, February 4th. The intro to this article: if social media and the advertising industry are to be believed, new motherhood is a site of self-actualization, one brimming with nourishing moments. Suddenly swaying the baby in a neutral-colored Scandinavian wrap, a few sleepless nights perhaps, and some slapstick events involving dirty diapers. Thank God for literature complicating that narrative. In a new collection of poems about maternal mental health, All That We Ask of You Is to Always Be Happy, Durham poet Bridget Bell does just that. Bell, who teaches composition and literature at Durham Technical Community College, defines postpartum depression in one poem as, quote, a window painted shut, a cornered mouse frantic along the floorboards, wheels on black ice, spinning, spinning, spinning. The impossible ask in Bell's title feels truer than ever, especially of women suffering from postpartum depression. That's a condition that affects, as the introduction notes, 15 to 20% of mothers. Across 33 poems, the forces of postpartum spinning show up: sleep deprivation, psychosis, loneliness, intrusive thoughts. Some poems are a fairly brutal read. All are raw, lyrical, and inventive. People who are parents may find it a relief to see these experiences articulated honestly. People who are not parents will find it riveting and educational. Ahead of the book's release, a launch celebration at Pony Saurus on February 8th, and a reading at Mettleson Theater on March 22nd, Bell sat down with Indy to talk about the collection. And here we go with my two-voice interview format. How long have you been working on these poems? Did they start during your first pregnancy? I first started writing about the topic a month after I had my daughter. I have 2 children. I can remember the first poem that I wrote, and it's not actually in the collection. And the poems kind of started as a way of processing what I was going through after I had her, because I struggled with postpartum depression. Initially, I wasn't imagining it as a book, because I couldn't imagine anything in the future. Everything was so debilitating. But the further away I got from being sick, and the further I got along on my healing process, I started to think about how powerful it could be to have a collection that would potentially help other women. So I really wrote it over the course of 6 years. Some of the poems were very acute in response to things I experienced, and then some are in response to other stories I've heard or research I've done. Was it hard to sit the materials that long, or cathartic to have a mechanism to think through things, or both? It was cathartic. It was definitely hard too, that I have an amazing community of writers who helped me workshop the poems, and so I always felt very safe in the content. I feel very passionate about talking about maternal mental health, so even if the content was difficult for me, I felt driven by the idea that talking about it and have the poems out in the world could help combat some of the stigma. Can you talk a bit about the collection title, which is great? Thank you. I had a couple different working titles as I was putting together the manuscript, and none of them ever felt quite right. For a long time, the manuscript was called Normal, because I wanted to emphasize how common perinatal mood disorders are, but that didn't capture everything that I wanted. When I thought of All That We Ask of You Is to Always Be Happy, it sounds cheesy, but it was kind of one of those click-into-place moments. As someone who uses dark humor to cope with things, the snarkiness of that title felt like it hit on the different notes I wanted the collection to hit on. It's in the direct conversation with this message that moms get, and not just new moms, but parents in general, you know, to cherish every moment, and oh, this time goes by so fast. But it's really super, super hard, and the moments that are cherishable are few and far between. There's a lot of struggle and boredom and resentment. I don't think the title is unique to motherhood either. I think it's applicable to a lot of expectations that we put on women. I really like that plural first person. There's this ominous we. It's not even necessarily like one person is giving a direct message. It's just this amorphous pressure you feel from every angle. That first person plural felt important. Do you have poetry or literature to look to for writing about maternal mental health? What's out there? My daughter's 10, so it's been a decade since this started, I think. A lot has changed, and there's probably more literature out there, but I can remember how hungry I was for poems about maternal mental health specifically. And I can remember Googling maternal postpartum depression poetry, and I couldn't find a whole lot. I read a lot of other women's writing while I was working on this, but they weren't necessarily postpartum depression poems. There were more poems about similar things that the collection explores, having people dismiss you, or the shame of not fulfilling societal expectations. I think there are a lot of stories about postpartum depression, like memoirs. Postpartum Support International is a great resource. And they have a blog and a section called Stories of Hope that I would read a lot. I do feel there's a gap in poetry specifically, and maybe that's people's hesitancy because there's this pushback in the poetry world to not be overly sentimental. I always got that message in grad school. So I don't know if people are reluctant to write about it because they don't want to seem overly sentimental. But I don't think the subject is sentimental. I think it's wrought with anger and angst and complex emotions. The book has a foreword by a doctor, and there's a lot of medical language. Kevin Carey is the publisher. They have a series they publish that's called Laurel Books, and it's a series dedicated specifically to books about living with any illness, whether that's physical or mental. All of their Laurel books have a medical foreword to couch the collection in the scientific realm. Through pure luck, I guess, I have a very good friend who's best friends with Dr. Rhea Patterson, who is the director of UNC's Perinatal Mood Disorders Clinic. So I already knew Rhea, and she was just the perfect person to have written the medical foreword. She's a mother, too. That felt really, really lucky. I also wanted to weave the academic language throughout, because people do sometimes dismiss perinatal mood disorders. As you know, women overacting are like, it's just the baby blues. It was important to me to get the scientific language in there to emphasize that these are researched medical problems with a rich body of academic research behind them and that they aren't women being overly emotional or women being sad because they're tired. For the people you've given this to, maybe women have had pregnancies or struggled with maternal health, maternal mental health, what's the reaction been? I've cried in response to basically everything people have said to me. People have been so generous in their reception of the book and said such kind things to me, like, you really are just giving voice to some of the darker things I experienced and wasn't able to say. What kind of researches are out there for people experiencing perinatal mood disorders? What was helpful to you? This is the final answer in this interview. The biggest thing I want people to know is that there are super treatable medical conditions. And if you think something is wrong, stick to your guns with that. You might get messaging, oh, you're just tired, or it's normal to cry after your baby is born. But you know if something is wrong. If you can't advocate for yourself because it's too debilitating, telling someone that you trust that you need help and asking them to get you that help, I think, is huge. I went to a support group through UNC. It's now defunct, but even if you can't physically get to a support group, there are a lot of online groups. And going to that for me was huge because I knew I was going to be in a space with other women who were not going to judge me. It was also super helpful to see other women who are a little bit further along in their recovery process. I remember a woman saying she woke up one day and remembered that when she felt bad, it was the worst she'd ever felt. But she couldn't actually remember how bad it felt to feel that bad because she was healing. That really stuck with me. Also, if it works for you, don't be afraid to take the medicine, because I was. And I think many people are hesitant to take medicine. I was afraid to get on antidepressants because I was nursing and I was going to harm the baby. I was afraid I was going to harm the baby. I would have gotten better eventually, but I feel like the medication saved me in the acute moment. I know everyone has different feelings about medication, but use all the resources available to you. Once again, the author, Bridget Bell, the poet, Cavancari Press, title, All That We Ask of You Is to Always Be Happy. A short article now in the music realm about Reese Palmer from Durham, who pays tribute to country music's Holy Trinity. And they read this not an immediate booking, but she's beginning a tour in mid-February. Durham-based country artist Reese Palmer's hitting the road as a co-headliner of Trailblazing Women of Country Tour, a tribute to the legends Patsy Cline, Loretta Lynn, and Dolly Parton. The tour will pair Palmer with Georgia-born vocalist Christina Train and feature an all-female backing band. Palmer, currently recording in Nashville, tells Indy she's most excited to perform Cline's hit ballad Walkin' After Midnight and Loretta Lynn's lesser-known lament Somebody Somewhere. She wrote in an email, I don't sound like either singer, so I'm bringing my own vocal sensibilities to both songs, keeping the meaning of the lyrics in mind. And let's see. Co-headliner Train wrote in a press release, when we think of the mainspring of country music, we're immediately referencing this Holy Trinity, Dolly, Loretta, and Patsy. With each concert on this tour, our group of fantastic women and musicians, along with everyone present in the room, will experience a joyful celebration honoring what these legends have given us. The thematic tour, according to the press release, pays homage to the ways that Cline, Lynn, and Parton offered their, quote, uniquely empowered and unmistakably female perspective on issues faced by women of their day through country music. This tour announcement comes as Palmer prepares for another major performance closer to home. This April, She'll take part in Biscuits and Banjos, a three-day festival in downtown Durham, celebrating Black roots music. The festival, organized by MacArthur Fellow and Pulitzer Prize winner Rhiannon Giddens, marks the 20th anniversary of that influential Black banjo gathering in Boone that helped spark a revival of multiracial, intergenerational, old-time music. Palmer wrote in her mail, Rhiannon is doing something really special with this festival. At the festival, Palmer will present a live version of her Apple Music radio show, Color Me Country, featuring her touring band, The Smoke, as the house band, alongside special performances by North Carolina country and Americana artists. The upcoming tour and festival appearance add to an already momentous period for Palmer, who earned a Grammy nomination in 2022 and was named to Rolling Stone's Future 25 list in 2021. Palmer also plans to release a new album this spring. The Trailblazing Women of Country Tour begins February 20 at the Newberry Opera House in Newberry, South Carolina. And again, Biscuits and Banjos takes place mid-April, April 25 through 27, right in downtown Durham. Well, I'm recording this at midday, and of course at midday, my thoughts often go to food and beverages. And here's a story about Michael's English Muffins over in Raleigh, which has found a cult following, writes Elliot Harrell. Take owner Annabelle Commissar's recent trip to New York City, where an acquaintance mentioned that her best friend also lived in Raleigh and texted her to say that she was with the owner of Michael's English Muffins. At the time, Commissar laughed, thinking chances were slim the reference would ring any bells. But the Raleigh connection instantly responded, gushing she was a devotee of Michael's and a frequent visitor to the farmer's market to buy them. And so it goes for Commissar and her muffins, which she's been making since 2014. She's overnighted muffins to Italy for a fan's mom, sends quarterly shipments to a fan in Florida, and during the holidays has to restock her muffins multiple times a week at Ladyfingers because they're so popular. Originally from Ohio, Commissar grew up in a restaurant industry. Her father, who is named Michael, owned the Maisonette, a much-lauded French restaurant in Cincinnati. It was there, Commissar says, that her attention to detail and fixation on quality began. In her late 20s, Commissar learned to make English muffins from scratch while working in a local artisan bakery. The following year, she moved to Raleigh to work as a wine distributor. Her muffins soon followed. She says of her first foray into business, I started making muffins off the balcony of my apartment complex with a griddle. I would take them to chefs, and they would say, if you had a certified kitchen, I would totally buy them. She didn't have one, but a friend offers her his with a catch. He said I could use his kitchen when his staff wasn't there. So it's from 11 p.m. to 9 a.m. In 2015, Commissar officially launched Michael's English Muffins. The name is a nod to her father's hospitality prowess. At first, Commissar sold the muffins at local farmers' markets while trying to grow a wholesale business. But in 2018, she found a retail location on Capitol Boulevard in North Raleigh. People thought I was crazy, she says of the spot's location. It's off the beaten path. Her retail spot sells muffins, of course, but a mix of sandwiches, such as the It's a Gouda Day sandwich with Gouda cheese, pimento, bacon spread, and more bacon. She forged ahead, adamant that she could make it work and she'd finance it all herself. She says it was all sweat equity. I didn't want to owe anyone any money. Since then, the muffins have made their way into over 50 restaurants, cafes, and other retail locations, mostly around the Triangle. In December, Commissar announced that 8 local Food Lions will also carry her muffins. So what makes these English muffins, which retail for $9.50 to $10.50 per four-pack, worthy of a cult following? The answer, Commissar says, is fairly simple. Time and our process. Dough is fermented overnight, often up to 24 hours, before it's rolled out, proofed, cooked on a griddle, and finally cooled before being packaged. The result? A perfectly chewy, pillowy muffin that's thick enough to get nice and toasted on the outside while staying soft on the inside. You may never want to eat a standard grocery store version again after trying one. She says, no one else makes English muffins from scratch here. This, considering how the Triangle's diverse range of donut options, or the fact you can just about throw a rock and hit a biscuit spot in the South, makes her business stand out. The original flavor is Commissar's best seller, but she's partial to the sweet potato cinnamon version. Her other flavors right now are everything, fruit, and rosemary and olive oil, but Commissar says she'd love to add new flavors like fennel in the future. While she's still excited about the business's growth and recent foray into her first big box retailer, quality is still her North Star. She says, I don't ever want to break the tipping point, adding that if Michael's English muffin gets big, her team will continue to use the same attention to detail for every muffin they make. As for what she thinks about the local loyalty to her muffins, people tells me there's a cult, she laughs. But I think the community in the South and in Raleigh is just very supportive of local products. Fading up behind me is our theme music, and I should stop now. I do have a few articles I haven't read, and I still am putting them aside. Hopefully I'll have some time to include them. Another poetry article, a long article about the closing of a Southern Season, a well-known grocery store over in Chapel Hill, and several others. Well, but John Feddersen must bid you farewell now. This article, this issue of Indie Week is now a podcast, and you can hear it at your pleasure. Anytime, go to our website, ncreadingservice.org. Thank you very much for listening to Indie Week. Bye-bye.